Hi, my name is Don Hahn. I'm the producer of Lion King and Beauty and the Beast, and you're listening to the Pixar Podcast.
To infinity and beyond!
So, how long is this going to take?
You can't rush art.
What's the point of going out there? They'll only laugh at you.
That's because you're a clown!
Stranger, from the outside.
Greetings! You're not the queen. You don't smell like the queen.
I never look back, darling. It distracts from the now.
How do you feel?
Squirrel! I feel swell. In fact, I think I feel a song coming on.
Hey, good evening. How are you? How are you? Nice to see you. Hey, it's great to be here in your room. Where are you from?
Hello there, Pixar fans. Welcome to another episode of the Pixar Podcast. This is episode number 104. Show notes for this episode are available at thepixarpodcast.com/104. I'm Derek Clements, and I'm very excited to play for you this episode today. We are going to go major behind the scenes of Pixar's latest short film, The Blue Umbrella. I had two opportunities to speak with the director of that film, Sashka Unseld, and I'm going to play them both for you here. The first one is going to be back from April, a roundtable conversation with some other journalists and bloggers that were there at Pixar. And then after that, I'm going to play for you a recent interview that I did with director Sashka Unseld, just me and him. So I hope you really enjoy it and learn a lot about this short film. Just to remind you, John Bryan's wonderful score to this film is available on iTunes, and I could not have been more excited about that. So I'm sure you all are aware of that already, but if you're not, go to iTunes and check it out. John Bryan is one of my favorite composers, and his score to The Blue Umbrella is really quite great. All right, well, without further ado, I will go ahead and get to both interviews now with director Sashka Unseld, the director of The Blue Umbrella.
Perfect. That was a really fantastic short.
Thank you.
I think it's the first short where I've looked at that. Is that digital?
Yeah.
Is that animation? Was that your intention to get as close as possible to the real world?
Have
a breakthrough then.
Apart from that, I'm interested in pushing kind of the medium of animation, because you can basically visually do anything you want to do. There's no reason that there, out of some reason, is an established look for CG animation. There's no reason for that, and it can be anything. And I think hopefully in the future everyone's going to open up to that more. But in The Blue Umbrella, it was about this. For me, the film is so much also about when it rains in a city, the city becoming this magical place. And part of it is the umbrellas coming to life, but part of it is the city coming to life. And I had done a test that I shot on my phone, where I shot just where I was living, faces that I saw and things, and then in my computer I animated them to a song at that time, because I thought of it as a music video. And when I showed that to people, and I showed that during my pitch as well here at Pixar, there was this... It felt so fascinating, that moment between, oh, this is reality, and then I had exactly the same first character as in the film, the first blink, and people were like, oh, what is going on there? Because you don't expect it. You set up to something, and then you change the perception. And that... I'm fascinated by magic, and I think this is a magical moment, that something is not there, and then something that you take as a character and has feelings is there. And that worked only so well since it you're set up for it to be real and then slowly descend into this magical world. And that was the core why it worked so well, and why I really wanted to do it, and, you know, because it's fun and amazing to look at, but because the magic is there if it's a real city.
I think you sort of answered my question, but I know, especially when I was younger, I would see faces everywhere, and here they actually become alive. Mm-hmm. Was that kind of where some of this started? You just sort of walk around seeing faces everywhere?
The idea, so for the test, I said that I shot on my phone, where I just had some characters. That's where this idea came from. But the initial idea for the film was from an umbrella I had found in the city, or I saw in the city lying in the gutter, kind of like this one moment in the film. And which to me just looks always incredibly sad, mostly because someone just threw it away or lost it and then doesn't even bother to go back there, which is just really sad. And so that was the initial spark for the idea of telling a story with an umbrella, and I had multiple versions of that story. The first one was the umbrella wants to get back to his owner, kind of like a breakup story. Someone breaks up with you and you want to still be with that person. I never had a happy end there, though. So I went through different ideas of what stories to tell, and at one point it became me thinking about the rain and about what I like so much about it. And it rains really rarely here. It rains more than in LA, but still it rains like, I don't know, 5 days a year or something like this. And where I grew up in Germany, in Hamburg, in the north, it rains a lot. Like, it's known for being overcast 80% of the year. So I thought it would be so nice to make a short that is also, apart from the story, is also a love declaration to the rain. It shows the rain as a beautiful thing, like everyone hates the rain, but someone actually really loves the rain, which is of course an umbrella. And when I thought of it as a love declaration to the rain, I thought it should be a love story. The city would become this magical, beautiful place when it rains. And that's when I remembered this test I had done for something that was a music video idea at the time. I thought, what if not just the umbrellas come to life, but what if the whole city comes to life? And that's when the two kind of came together. And that's when slowly the idea for the photo wheel came in as well. It didn't start out like this at all, because with an umbrella and nothing else, it could have been anything.
So John Bryan, I mean, mm-hmm. I was so excited to know that he was doing the music for this, and then listening to it, it just is so beautiful. What was it like working with him, and do you think he'll work at Pixar again?
I mean, it was daunting and fascinating and crazy to work with him.
Huh.
He works at night, for example. Like, he gets up at 8 in the evening. So basically a working session with him would be like, I'm here the whole day, fly down to LA at 6 in the evening after my work day, and meet with him at 8 or 9 in the evening when he's just having coffee and waking up. And then we work for 2 hours, and then kind of I fall asleep while he works the night, and then I fly back in the morning. And he's amazing. Like, his I don't know if any of you ever know about his show at the Largo in LA. He kind of does impromptu songs. Like, the audience shouts songs. When I saw it, he actually was doing it acoustic, and someone said Michael Jackson medley. And he just, on a guitar, on the spot, without knowing anything, did like a 10-minute Michael Jackson medley going through like 20 songs. Amazing. So that was fascinating. It was in the beginning a lot was finding the melody. He had this, when I pitched him the short, he instantly got it, which was amazing, and instantly got what it needed. Because we met with a couple of composers and it ended up being him, and he instantly understood what we need is, we need kind of like a 5-note melody, something really short and catchy, kind of like the Singing in the Rain thing or something like this, which is just 5 notes long, which gives us the flexibility to suddenly shift moods on a dime. Because it's a 7-minute short film and we go through so many different emotions. We don't have the time in a classical score for a feature to take a minute to shift into sad and then shift back into happy, but we also want some really catchy melody. So a lot of the working time in the beginning was to find that 5-6 note melody that feels really catchy, feels really fresh and unique, but that we could play happy and sad and kind of shift the music around with the picture. And then we had, as the voice was Sarah Jaffe, which was funnily, which I still is one of my favorite details, is that the test I shot on my phone, which I thought would be a music video, that was to one of her songs.
Oh, wow.
Before even the story was there. Huh. But everyone loved her voice so much. And we looked into tons of other singers, but everyone was like, nah, it doesn't have this thing that Sarah has. So she is the vocals, and John Bryan Gordon is the score.
Talk to the people who designed the architecture for the buildings, and they mentioned a lot about how they kind of tried to incorporate faces within them.
In Monsters.
Was it something kind of intentional that your short comes before this, or was it just some sort of divine bringing
completely
together?
Lucky coincidence. Wow. The way the features and the shorts are paired up is just production schedule. Like, I pitched my short 2011, And then we slowly were able to get people that were finishing up on features. At that time, people were finishing on Brave, and I could get them on my short in 2012. So we finished in time for Monsters. But there's no intention beforehand, oh, let's not release this short now, because in 3 years there might be a feature where it fits perfectly. Just kind of, as soon as they're done, we want everyone to see them.
Why is it the blue umbrella and not like the green umbrella?
I think initially it was just somehow that was, when I thought of the idea, somehow that three-word title just popped into my head. I don't know why. But then, of course, I went into thinking, okay, well, it could be any color. And it should stand out from this crowd of gray umbrellas. So it needs to be a color, and because he's happy about it. And he loves the rain. And rain is water, and water should be blue. It was like, that's just the color that fitted the best to a character that loves the rain.
So was it a specific New York street that we were looking at? Was it a composite of New York streets? Was it a complete digital recreation of
a city? It's a complete digital recreation. Okay. And it's a mix of cities as well. Like, a lot of it is New York. The biggest reason for that was New York's the only city that has sidewalks that are really wide. Mm. And I wanted this sea of umbrellas. And you can only get that with a wide sidewalk. Otherwise, you have like two umbrellas next to each other. It's boring. We actually doubled the width compared to the New York sidewalks. And I wanted these street canyons. I wanted hundreds of busy people going along their day. And the owner of the blue umbrella always having his commute where he goes, and everyone goes in one direction, but then this umbrella wants to go the other direction. But I never wanted it to be a specific city. Kind of, we shied away from using iconic landmarks or anything like this. And some of the city characters are from San Francisco, and it's more a composite of a big city. There's actually one of them, the blue umbrella just comes out, and he looks over and he sees on the other side of the street this roof with two windows and where the kind of the rain pipes to the mouth. That is from Paris. That's something Harley Jessup came in for kind of a bit of a brainstorm session about faces in cities. And he just looked back into his field trip from Ratatouille, where he had done all those photos in Paris, and he found this rooftop he really liked. So it's a composite of big cities, and I wanted it to be non-specific place-wise, and to a certain extent also non-specific time-wise. I mean, some traffic lights set it more now than in the 30s, but I like the idea of the place being symbolic and placeless, and the time being timeless.
What was the San Francisco reference?
San Francisco, some of the city characters are San Francisco, like the very first one. The city characters, the very first city character that comes to life, this kind of cover in the sidewalk, we call it Lisa. All the characters had names because we need to refer to them somehow. When someone new comes on, they always thought we're crazy because they have all these names. What are you talking about? We had a poster with all the names. But that is a specific San Francisco thing, actually. Those things don't exist in New York. Like, when I went on trips to look at stuff, it's amazing how different details in cities are. And a lot of it, I don't think these outlets exist in cities where it actually rains a lot, because I don't think they're good for tons of rain falling down. And in New York, it's very different the way these details are built into the city. So those are very specific San Francisco.
So to go back to the photorealism topic, we're not in a place where a whole feature could be that photoreal, right? Or are we? I mean, I didn't know that we were at a place where a short could be so photoreal, because it really did look like photorealistic. So are there limitations still if you were to make a feature film, a feature-length film?
I don't think there's any limit. I mean,
really?
Because I think that has more to do with a perception of that there's a separation between animated films and live action films, but Avatar or The Hobbit or even The Avengers,
sure.
I mean, how much of that is CG and looks photoreal?
Yeah.
It's more that now there is no distinction anymore. It's about the stories you tell and the kind of about the world you tell. And it's interesting because it used to be like this. I mean, when Toy Story 1 came out, that was probably the only story you could tell, because it was plastic and metal and stone, and you couldn't do human skin and people. It was impossible. And it took until The Incredibles that you actually could do a CG animated feature with humans. Before, it was not like, you wouldn't want to look at those, and technology-wise, it wasn't possible.
Yeah.
But I think by now that has completely disappeared. I don't think there's any limitation to it. And I think by now the only limitation there is more in our heads, that everyone thinks like this is how an animated movie looks like.
Sure.
So you kind of, without thinking of it, you just kind of imagine a film like this. And it's more about getting out of that mold and thinking like, no, you can do anything, and just stop thinking within the fixed realm that we think was established.
Yeah, so where do you see that? What possibilities open up for you? I mean, I think like you could have biopics that are animated from, rather than casting someone that looks like a figure, you could just make, you know, animate someone. What are the possibilities you see with that that technique?
I think there's two things. One is going more photoreal, but the other one is going also more painterly and more abstract. Like, there's no reason to... One detail would be, for example, how... We used so much shallow depth of field in the short, and when I talked with the tech people about it, I started to think like, wait a second, the way depth of field or out of focus stuff looks in the background is based on a real camera currently, and we wanted photoreal, so it makes sense. But theoretically, that could be more painterly. Theoretically, when something goes out of focus, it could become more like kind of abstract paint strokes or something like in watercolor paintings, where it kind of bleeds more out. Like, there's, you can go way more painterly with the stuff you can do. Ultimately, the hard part of it, though, is not even the technology, but is having a story where it makes sense that you use that look.
Sure.
And don't just do it for the effect.
Yeah.
And that was why everyone was excited about the short, because it makes sense from the story that it's photoreal and wasn't just like a visual gimmick to it.
Yeah.
So I think it's about finding the stories that want to be told in a different look and in a different style, because that makes sense for them.
What about if you do something, you know, different, what would that be? One thing, you look back and like at the whole process of creating the group.
There's probably tons of stuff. Like, it's there's like, and I think that's to a certain extent true to everyone in live action, has a bit of luck because they do their principal photography and then they can't really go back. I mean, they do sometimes, but it costs so much money, the kind of the border is to do that is really hard. But there's a saying here that you never finish on a movie, it just gets released. And it is literally true. Like, Pixar is a group of, and I mean that in the best possible way, obsessive people about detail. And that's fantastic, because everyone loves what they're doing and puts so much work into it. And there's, I mean, if I would pick things, and that's, I mean, that's part of directing. Part of directing in animation is knowing what is important, what do you kind of manically hold onto and you really want to get in there. And which things you're like, yeah, I wanted these things, but they're not as important as the other things. Kind of ranking them and letting go of certain stuff. And there's tons of stuff I let go of. There's the moment when, after the crash, Blue lies on the side of the street, and we have a shot where the owner walks in. And I initially always thought that shot would be into a puddle, where we see the reflection completely kind of through the dirty puddle of the umbrella, and then we pan up and we see the real umbrella, which would have taken a lot of work. And the shot works now as well, it just doesn't have this detail in there. And there's tons of stuff like this. There's a lot of editing things I wanted to be more experimental with. I wanted it to feel more like a documentary. We have that in some parts where we actually have a long shot where we just cut out the middle. Like, when she crosses the street, she starts walking, we have a cut of the same shot but later, and I feel like there's tons of editing things and camera things to make things feel more real. It's not just that it looks real. Where we could have done more experimentation in the stereo version, we could have done more experimentation, but at one point you kind of need to finish, sadly.
We have time for two more questions.
So, sorry, not too many questions, but you obviously made a deliberate decision to avoid any human faces. I can imagine that's sort of a happy collision of circumstances, right? Because it it helps with the theme of the faces and the buildings, and it sort of gets over the uncanny valley thing of we can't quite do faces that look 100% real.
I think we can do faces, it's just a shitload of work. But we actually, sometimes we had a bit more of the owners, even their feet were featured more prominently initially, and it always led us down this path of, as an audience, we were thinking too much about what are the owners doing down there. And then it becomes a really tricky territory, like, oh, the umbrella just moved like this, what is the owner doing right now? You think you get too much distracted from the umbrellas. So it's completely true what you said. It was to a certain extent a lucky coincidence that conceptually and story-wise, we don't want to think too much about the owners. There's a few spots and we end kind of with them because they found each other as well, but during the whole thing in the middle, we don't want to think about them, so we didn't want to show their faces. But acting-wise, it was actually really important to cast them, because the animators need to move them. And if you don't know what characters they are, you move them mechanically and you don't do anything. So I had cast the sidekick from Singing in the Rain, who I love, Donald O'Connor. It was he, and she was, because I didn't want too much gender stereotype, which I hate. She always tended to become pink. I was like, no, red. It was Maggie from Northern Exposure, if you ever seen that amazing TV show. There's the airplane pilot who I love. So that was kind of the team up of the owners.
You mentioned Singing in the Rain a couple times. So is that a favorite film of yours?
There's probably way too many favorite films of mine. To a certain extent, I mean, there are no favorite films. There are favorite films for different reasons.
Sure.
But if I need to name one, which sometimes people ask me, it's Wim Wenders' Wings of Desire. Mm. Have you ever seen that? And I actually tried to have things in here. Like the first time when the rain falls, I wanted to just calm down and not kind of show flashy effects or whatever. And it's one of my favorite moments in the film still, is just a raindrop that hits the ground. Just another raindrop that hits a mailbox and makes a different sound because of it. And Wings of Desire has that patience and that calmness and that attention to detail, because I think all these things are beautiful. And I got obsessive with how asphalt cracks, because the cracks are really beautiful. I did just on the side for fun a photo series of asphalt, and it nearly looks like paintings, the way it ages and weathers and all these things. And those are kind of things I really wanted to have in there.
Thank you very
much.
Well, I am so excited to be talking to you today. I actually had a chance to see the short film again this week. By now, listeners will have had a chance to see Monsters University and watch the short, The Blue Umbrella. And so I'm just so excited to be talking to you today, and I'm sure my listeners are excited as well.
Awesome. Fantastic.
So I have to tell you, I'm new to New York City. I'm here for just for the summer. Mm-hmm. And when I was at Pixar, I got a Blue Umbrella with me, and I thought I'll take that along in case it rains. And it rained the other day, and I was so excited because I was able to use my Blue Umbrella, and you know, as I was walking around in the rain holding the umbrella, something sort of clicked about the short that sort of, you know, it was enjoyable when I was watching it the first time, but when I was actually in the rain in the city with an umbrella, I was like, oh, you know, that short really speaks to something true here. And I'm wondering if you can talk about that. What do you think the short speaks to? What do you think it captures about being in a city?
I'm a city boy. I love cities. And a bit of it for me is there's like a community in a city. You're like in this together, especially when it rains. It's this group of people and kind of they're all dealing with the rain and they're all holding umbrellas. There's kind of a community thing to it. And the same thing with all the city faces. They all know each other. They're friends and they do this every time it rains. And there's some feeling of kind of closeness and of helping each other out and kind of in being in this place together that I really like in cities. And I think hopefully that shines through in the short as well.
Yeah. Well, and why do you like the rain? I mean, it seems like a lot of people don't like the rain.
It might be just that I live now in California and it barely ever rains and I just miss it. I chatted with people in Germany and they were like, yeah, only if you live somewhere where it doesn't rain anymore could you miss the rain. But it's actually not true. Even when I was living in Hamburg, I really liked the rain. Somehow, it changes the mood in a city so much. It kind of... The sounds change, the sounds get muffled, you mostly have this sound of the rain, and especially at night, everything becomes kind of glittery and kind of glossy, and all these reflections, it's nearly like Christmas time. Everything is sparkling. And for me, I think what rain does in a city is, as people, you move closer together. Sit in a cafe and you look out into the rain and it kind of everyone warms up inside and it has a warmth to it. It creates a warmth in a city to me. And part of that is the harshness of it, that people go inside and then warm up and all that. And I feel like that's more the soul of it for me. That's more the core of it for me. And that's why, for me, the short is kind of... I said that before, that's why the short became a love story. It's because for me... The film was supposed to be a love declaration to the rain, and then I was like, "Oh, wait a second! Then it should be a love story because that's the right way to communicate this feeling."
Yeah. Huh. Okay. So, what was it like to turn that into a short? What was that process like? Feeling.
It was great. I mean, a lot, like half a year or something. It was me writing the short or kind of coming up with the idea, with basically the breakthrough being that I wanted to be a love declaration to the rain, and then coming up with a love story. Because beforehand, that love story didn't exist. I had like different other versions of the film. And then it was great here because there's so many fantastically talented people we can just show the story reels to. So we did a first version of the story reels, showed it to not only John Lasseter, but a bunch of the story people on the Anchorage and just generally people who are here, amazingly talented artists, and kind of give their feedback on what they understood, what they didn't understand, but also what they loved in it, and kind of trying to figure out, okay, where is the heart of it that really connects with people, and then kind of elaborating more on these things and kind of cutting shorter the things that don't work to people that much.
And then that feeling of the rain, how did you lock into that creative space where you were able to capture what that feeling is like in a short?
It was tricky because of the photo reel look of the whole thing. Yeah. During the production, we didn't know exactly how it's going to look like. Because it's going to look so different, we kind of could imagine how it would look like, but we couldn't see it. So you couldn't really build on previous experience. Yeah. You could just think like, okay, I think when it's done, it's going to feel like this watching it. But of course, every version we watch during the production is just kind of everything's gray or there's none of the pretty photo realness in the end. So it just took a lot of
imagination during the process of not looking at what we see on the screen. And in a certain extent, closing your eyes and just imagining how it would be in the end and making calls based on that instead of what you actually see on screen.
Oh, I see. So do you think that is different from, say, traditional animation where you have an idea for something, you scribble it down, you're able to have that instant feedback? With computer animation, is there more of a delay there? You have to use your imagination a bit more?
Maybe a bit. I mean, compared to live action, it's the same.
Because right,
animation is upside down compared to live action. In live action, you shoot it, and then when you edit it, when you try to figure out how long a shot is or which shot to use, you do that at the very end. While the strange thing in animation is you do that before you have anything. Like you cut just the storyboards, or then you edit just the rough layout where nothing is pretty, where nothing is fine, where none of the acting is in there. But you have to decide on the editing already. So it's in a strange way kind of the opposite direction that you work. And that's the tricky part of it.
Yeah. So, Sashka, you went to film school in Germany, correct?
I went to film school in Ludwigsburg. It's a tiny town close to Stuttgart. And there's a school called the Film Academy, and they have an animation and visual effects program there. I initially thought I would do visual effects, but then during my studies, I just fell in love with animation even more. And Toy Story 1 just had come out, so CG animation on a bigger scope did not exist. It existed kind of a bit in commercials and, of course, in the shorts that Pixar had done before Toy Story. But it wasn't as existing as a film, as a storytelling medium as it was. And then when that came out, I just instantly switched.
Do you remember when you first thought that computer animation might be a storytelling medium?
Yeah, and that was when I saw Toy Story, the first Toy Story in the cinema. It was the year I graduated high school. So it was before I went to film school even. But also, when I went to film school, I didn't think that would be a possibility of ever doing something like Pixar did at that time. But during my study, I was like, maybe there might be a chance of actually doing CG animated shorts. And that's when I kind of initiated my desire to switch to animation.
Did you ever plan on doing live action film? Did you ever do that? Or were you always sort of in the more...
Part of my studies were live action shorts. So the first year of my film studies was actually traditional live-action filmmaking. So I directed a live-action short, did camera on a live-action short, wrote scripts for live-action. Because everyone, no matter what you study, if you study live-action directing or script writing or animation, everyone needs the same basis in kind of filmmaking education.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's the same. And you've talked about this too, that you can tell any story with animation. And it's you know, a film is a film, whether it's animated. And when I was at Pixar in the roundtable, you mentioned that a lot of live action movies today have animation in them, like, and it's seamless.
Ultimately, what the story requires. I mean, to a certain extent, Blue Umbrella, I didn't write it thinking this is an animated movie or this is a live action movie or this is whatever. It was just about the story you want to tell.
Yeah,
and then you figure out what is the best visual way of telling that. If you have a film like Monsters, you probably want it in a more stylized way because you don't want the monster to be look like all the monsters, because you want the monsters to be actually nice creatures.
Yeah.
So you have them more stylized, and the story dictates how it looks. And that's why the Blue Umbrella needed to look different, because I wanted it to be set in a real city.
Yeah. And there's got to be a pull, right, between what the story demands and what limitations there are. And I don't know exactly what those limitations might be, but I'm wondering maybe somehow budget or technology, or what are the limitations that would keep that perfect harmony of the story and the form, you know, matching perfectly. What are the limitations that make that difficult? Because, you know, the Blue Umbrella comes so close to just blowing those limitations away, it really does look photorealistic. And I just wonder about if those limitations are shrinking or something.
Yeah, no, you're completely right. I mean, they used to be limitations. When Toy Story 1 came out, the only thing you could possibly show on screen believable was hard plastic surfaces. And not humans. They keep the humans out as much as possible for a reason.
Right.
And it was actually in CG animated features. It wasn't until The Incredibles that there was a feature film with humans as the main characters, because until The Incredibles it wasn't even possible. And fur was a massive problem until Monsters came around. So there used to be all these kind of things you couldn't really do, but I don't think by now there's any limitations anymore. And I think the Blue Umbrella, more than anything else, proves that the only limitation is kind of what your story requires to look like and to be how visually it would look like ideally. But I think the limitation is more what you can creatively come up with and not what is technically possible anymore.
Hmm. Do you think that the limitations of expectations either by studios or audiences also plays a role in that? You know, the idea that an animated film will always have to look a certain way or things like that. Is that difficult to work through?
Yeah, but that's more something that's in people's heads. It's just kind of trying to get out of the mold of thinking, well, it's an animated film, so it should look like this.
Yeah.
But that was the great thing here, is that everyone was super excited about the idea of breaking that idea up a bit, of kind of being like, an animated film can be like this, and can be like this, and kind of just playing around a bit with the medium and how things can look like. And everyone, starting with John Lasseter, was super excited about doing that.
So tell me about pitching this. What I just want to know inside the head of somebody that's going to pitch a short at Pixar. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're Pixar employees that pitch these shorts. It's not outside people, I would imagine, usually. But what's it like to pitch a short? What was it like in your case?
It was weird because it was the first time I ever did it. Like, I've never pitched a short before or never pitched a story before. I've given presentations on things, but those are normally more making of things in the kind of a visual guy that you show things and say, like, this is how we made it. But a story in a pitch scenario I've never done before. So I was completely new to it. And I had no idea how others would do it. But how I did it was, basically, I just wrote the whole thing down in kind of a more how it would talk way. And it's like each of the three shorts I pitched was roughly, if I talk through it, 5 minutes long, the length of the short, basically. And it was exactly what happens in the shot. And the only visual thing I had is I had four pictures, kind of photos that I slightly kind of Photoshopped to put faces on the umbrellas and things like this. So when I first say that all the umbrellas are alive and in the middle of them is a bright blue umbrella, I turned over kind of a cardboard printout of a sea of umbrellas with a blue one in the middle where I'd drawn a face on. So just kind of to have a visual point and kind of to give more gravitas to this moment. The same thing when the red umbrella appears, the same thing when the blue umbrella lies in the gutter. And then the last one was for the happy end. Those were the four pictures I had. And the rest was literally just me specifically talking about the whole thing. So I think my pitch started with, I said, we are in a big city and the streets are full of cars and the sidewalks are busy with people, but then it starts to rain. And it doesn't just rain, it pours down like crazy. And the collective sigh goes to the crowds and hundreds of umbrellas pop up everywhere. And then from the crowd of grumpy people, we pan up and we see that all their umbrellas, they're laughing and they're smiling and they're happy and they're alive because they're finally out again in the rain. And this is kind of the first thing. And then I just talk through the whole story, basically.
Wow. Who was in the room at the time?
I went through two stages, or kind of two and a half stages. First, I worked with the development department here to kind of develop the story, but then also to improve my pitch. And then the first round of people was Pete Docter, who's the director of Up and the upcoming Inside Out. Then Bob Peterson, who's directing, co-directing with Pete Sohn, who was also in the room, the upcoming The Good Dinosaur. And then Ronita Carmen, who's a head of story, Jason Katz, who's a head of story. I think these were the five people in the first round that I pitched all three ideas to. And they loved all the stories, but they specifically fell in love with the Blue Umbrella. And they said that's something that, that John Lasseter might be really excited about if he hears it. And that was the second round, basically, pitching to John Lasseter.
Was there a reason that you had three story ideas as opposed to just one or more than three?
That's kind of the framework here, how it works. You don't pitch one idea, you pitch three ideas, which actually first seems a bit daunting because not only do we have to come up with one idea that you think could be a Pixar short and is good enough for that, but with three. While I was working on the ideas, while I was writing on them, it was really great because if I was stuck on one of them, and I was constantly stuck on one of those, I could just switch to another one and try to work on that for a while and then go back to the one I was stuck at. And it helped a lot in kind of not being frustrated with being stuck in a kind of in a dead end and just being able to keep on moving. Hmm.
So I imagine while you were having these ideas, while you're preparing your pitch and stuff, you also had a job at Pixar. And that job was what? In camera work, right?
Yeah, and at the time I was working on them, I was finishing up on Cars 2 and about to start on Brave.
Okay. And so what? How do you manage your time? Because it seems like, you know, you have tasks, you have... I'm just so sort of in awe of how creative companies like Pixar are able to use time, because it's something that's so organic. I would imagine you'd be doing a lot of your ideas at home on the side, but then it's sort of like your job is consuming your whole life. And so how do you draw the line? For you, did you come up with a lot of these ideas like at work? Like, okay, now I'm going to work on some ideas. Or was it more after work that you would come up with this stuff?
It was mostly after work. I think, though, that the subconscious part of my brain is probably constantly thinking about it. But it was ultimately, I found it really nice and relaxing because there wasn't the pressure of this week I have to fix this story problem. Or today I have to fix this story problem. It was like on some weekends I went out, I went to a cafe and wrote a bit until I felt like, okay, now I have a solid pass on all of them or now I'm stuck in one of them. But then I just let it go and there was no time pressure. So for the week I just went back and did the normal cinematography stuff I do. And then once I felt like, oh, I got an idea, I sat back down and wrote. It was a really luxurious way, actually, of working on them because I had all the time in the world. There was no pressure of, well, today at 3 o'clock, I need to have this problem fixed.
Yeah, that makes sense. And it sounds like it wasn't a sort of bad thing if it consumes your life for a while. I mean, what about other aspects of your life? It seems like if you're spending all your time, but your whole life is creative, right? So... That's how
Exactly. I mean, it's stuff I enjoy doing. It's like the stories and the worlds and the ideas and the characters. It nearly became like friends that I could spend time with. If I would sit down on a weekend in a cafe and just think about these stories, you feel like you're close to these characters. You think about what they would like, what they would do, how they feel like, what could happen to them. And after a while, it literally feels like you have this world of friends in your head that you can hang out with.
Hmm. Yeah. That's interesting. So you've talked about how it's the city is a sort of an amalgam of lots of cities, and there's a lot of New York in there. There's San Francisco, and I thought that I noticed a banner for the New York Public Library. Did I just make that up? I think there was like a lion. Did I totally invent that?
It's a complete Cassandra the amazing graphic artist here who did the poster as well. She did the banners as well.
A
complete made-up banner for a zoo, for Imaginative Zoo. We initially thought, actually, during the production, we were thinking of putting Monsters University banners there.
Nice.
Because it's filled with kind of Easter eggs anyhow, like the street names and everything is full of Easter eggs. But with the Monsters University banner, we changed it to a zoo banner because we didn't want... The risk was that people would get distracted.
Yeah.
You'd read Monsters University and it would throw you out of your movie because you'd suddenly become self-aware of that fact and all these kind of things. So we changed it to something as nondescript as possible.
I see. That makes sense. Well, I wouldn't have. I didn't notice it the first time I saw it, but then I've been seeing a lot of banners for the library that have a lion on it.
Yeah.
Made me think. Cool. Well, it's been so great to talk to you, Sashka. And I guess the final thing that I would just want to talk to you about is one of the other things that the short captures for me is, you know, and I feel like a lot of the great Pixar shorts have done this, where you look at inanimate objects in a different way. But this one really, really did make me think about umbrellas differently, because when you're in the rain in umbrellas, your umbrellas kind of tug at you because of the wind. I mean, the wind is tugging at you. But here, when that happened, it was part of the story. I mean, it was the umbrella wanted to get somewhere. And I just thought it was such a clever, interesting way of thinking about, you know, what could be a potentially frustrating thing is like, oh, I just want to get my umbrella down here. But in the story, you know, it's nice to think maybe it just wants to get to the person it loves and something like that. And then, you know, when the umbrella is there on the street and it's very sad. I mean, it's very, these are things that actually happen.
Yeah.
But there was just such life imbued in that. I don't really have a question, but I really like that part. And I wonder if you can just talk about that as we wrap up.
I think when I think back of when I was a young boy and went to the cinema, there was always like when you go to the cinema and the lights go out and you're in this dark room and there's this big screen and then the movie starts, there was always, I think the room always gets filled with a sense of magic and wonder, especially when I think of being a young kid and just like looking up to this huge screen and these worlds and these people and these stories happening. It's like magic. And that's what kind of cinema is to me. It's a sense of magic and wonder. And that's a bit, I think the soul of what I wanted the short to be a bit is kind of bringing that feeling I had as a young kid back on the screen, like this feeling of magic, this feeling of wonder, kind of this wide-eyed look at the screen and then coming out of the cinema and being completely enchanted by this and seeing the world different.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Sashka Unseld, it was so great to talk to you. What's next for you? Are you going to go back to doing camera stuff or what's next?
It's a complete mix of stuff. Like right now, this year is amazing because I traveled so much with a short. I was just last week in Annecy and we showed it there, which was an amazing reception. And then Monday we had the premiere in LA, and there's going to be a couple of other festivals coming up. One in Brooklyn, the Animation Block Party end of July.
Nice.
And then in between, when I'm here back at Pixar, I do camera stuff, a bit of The Good Dinosaur, which is coming out next year. And then, I mean, I always kind of have these ideas and characters that kind of I spend time with. And
yeah.
One day, I hope that they come to a quality level or kind of an excitement that I can do something with them.
Yeah, well, I hope so too. Wonderful short, and it was great to talk to you. Thanks for joining the Pixar podcast.
Thank you so much. This was great.
Okay, Squirt here will now give you a rundown on proper exiting technique.
It's just my ball.
Don't let it happen again.
Yes, well, I'll try to be less careless.
I'm watching you, Wazowski. Always watching.
It's got this kind of nice, burning, melty. It's not really a smoky taste. It's a certain, it's kind of like a, you know, it's kind of like this boom sap kind of taste. Don't you think? What would you call that flavor?
Lightning?
Don't look at the light!
I can't help it. It's so beautiful.
My name is Doug. I have just met you, and I love you.
Gone! It's all gone. All of it's gone. Bye-bye. Woo, see ya.
Thank you for listening to the Pixar Podcast.